From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Occupational licensing laws limit economic opportunity in North Carolina. A lawyer who helps fight these restrictions across the country recently visited Raleigh. He joins us to share his concerns. The University of North Carolina system has dealt with a number of recent controversies, but system leaders are also pointing to positive news in the year ahead. We'll have details. A school funding lawsuit dubbed Leandro has been kicking around the North Carolina court system for a quarter century. We'll get an update on recent developments. And we'll focus on the impact for North Carolina health care costs of more than 50 state insurance mandates. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
North Carolina schools employ more than 100,000 full-time teachers in traditional public schools and public charter schools. In the 2018-19 school year, average teacher pay was $53,975, and average total compensation reached nearly $73,000 when you factor in benefits as well. Dr. Terry Stoops joins us now with a look at teachers in North Carolina and where kids are actually receiving their education. He, of course, is the Vice President for Research, the Director of Education Studies here at the John Locke Foundation. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about teacher pay, because we are hearing and seeing all sorts of stories that teachers are not respected by North Carolina legislators, that they're not receiving adequate compensation. What's occurred over the past few years?
Well, let me break it into two parts. The first is the period between 2011 and 2014, when North Carolina was experiencing the aftermath of the recession and had huge shortfalls in funding for its Medicaid program. And during that period, the average teacher pay fell by $1,000, $1,500. And part of that is due to the makeup of the teacher workforce, which we could get into, but most of that was due to the fact that the Medicaid program was consuming so much money. If you look at teacher pay since 2014, the average has increased by $9,000. So the average teacher pay in 2014 was around $44,990, and now we're getting close to $54,000 as of last year. During this entire period, the money set aside for benefits has increased substantially. This includes pension contributions from the state, the amount for health care. North Carolina pays Social Security for teachers, as well as liability insurance. There's a statewide liability insurance for teachers. All of this combined to increase the value of their benefits package substantially. So not only big increases in pay, but even bigger increases in benefits.
And Terry, I wasn't aware of some of that benefit data until you actually wrote about this. And by the way, all of this data is available at johnlocke.org. Yet we do have a narrative that's been established in North Carolina that there is a disrespect of teachers by North Carolina lawmakers. The data doesn't seem to match that.
It definitely doesn't. And the way teachers are paid is an important part of this story. Essentially, there's a statewide salary schedule that's based on credentials and years of experience. And all teachers get paid according to that salary schedule. So the worst teacher gets paid the same as the best teacher if they have the same degrees and same years of experience. There are local supplements that are added to that. So the local school districts or local counties via of the school districts contribute some funds to that as well. I think the teachers that we're disrespecting are our best teachers who are subject to the salary schedule and are not paid according to their achievements or their abilities. Those are the teachers that are disrespected because they're getting paid the same as their lower performing counterparts. So you could understand why they would be so frustrated being in classrooms and teaching, knowing that they're doing a much better job than their colleagues, get paid the same or even less than some of their colleagues based on their years of experience and credentials.
That's such a great point. Is there any opportunity for a really outstanding teacher today in North Carolina to be able to receive compensation that it really is in line with their effectiveness and student achievement?
There are small grants, essentially, that the General Assembly has passed in recent years for the teachers that do excel on state tests, for career and technical education teachers, for teachers who teach advanced placement courses and are able to get a certain number of students passing the test for AP. The General Assembly has been mindful of providing funding for these small amounts of performance pay, but they're not very widespread. They're limited by grade and subject. And so that's one of the limitations to the way that teachers are paid. And certainly there is very, very little flexibility when it comes to what a school administrator could do to be able to pay a teacher more. So there has been progress in recent years, but there's such a big pushback on performance pay and incentive pay from those who frankly benefit from the fact that there's a statewide salary schedule, that it'll be very difficult for North Carolina to move to a system that pays teachers based on their ability and their performance.
I know that you have been urging policymakers to look more closely at those options, trying to keep those effective teachers in the classroom and compensated for their outstanding work. And then, of course, that takes you to the other side of the coin, which you would have in any business anywhere in this country, which is there are going to be some teachers who are less effective than they need to be. We also need to take a look at that.
That's right. And when we look at our teacher turnover data, it appears that the teachers that are leaving the profession are the less effective teachers, which is a good thing. We talk about teacher turnover so often as something that's terrible. But when we have bad teachers leaving the classroom, that's a win. That's a win for kids. It's a win for the classroom. It's a win for the school. It's a win for the district. So when we look at teacher turnover, we find that our least effective teachers are leaving. Unfortunately, our most effective teachers aren't getting paid what they should for staying in the classroom. And this is an important point, is that we should be paying teachers not because paying them additional funding, or our top teachers, paying them additional funding will make them perform any better. They'll perform just fine. But giving them the incentive to stay in the classroom and not pursue an administrative position or some other position to increase their pay.
Terry, let's turn our attention to how and where kids are being educated in this state. North Carolina, a huge state, of course, and we have been one of the leaders in the country in moving towards more choice, more options for parents. Give us a sense of where we are on that. Traditional public schools, are they still dominating the choice spectrum?
Yes, absolutely. So at this point, around 80% of our children go to a traditional or district school. And there are districts in the state that provide choices within those districts. So it's important to note that just because they're going to a district school doesn't mean that they don't have access to some sort of choice. But we have 20% that are attending schools of choice. 8% are going to home schools. Around 6% are going to charters, and 6% are going to private schools. We're seeing huge increases in the number of students that are being homeschooled and going to charter school. The private school population, despite having some private school voucher programs, really isn't increasing by much. Really, the growth in school choice that we're seeing is coming from the charter schools and the homeschools.
Yeah, those data points are really fascinating. Again, all of this available at johnlock.org. Terry, homeschools, 142,000 kids, public charter schools, 109,000. home schools, they're rocking it.
They really are, and their growth hasn't slowed. I think a lot of people expected that we would start seeing a leveling off, but there has been no leveling off of those homeschool students. And it looks like this year that the charter schools added around 7,000 kids compared to this point last year. So, you know, we had 109,000 last year. It looks like at this point we have about 118,000 based on some preliminary numbers. Compared to this point last year. I think that 109,000 was based on the number of students at the end of the last school year.
Terry, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are, and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Occupational licensing laws limit economic opportunity in North Carolina. During a recent Federalist Society speech in Raleigh, attorney Justin Pearson of the Institute for Justice explained how. He joins us now with more details. Why does this issue interest your group?
It's not the government's job to pick winners and losers in the marketplace. That choice belongs to consumers. And when you let consumers decide and you let people pursue their passions as entrepreneurs, all sorts of wonderful innovation happens. Additionally, you create jobs. So here in North Carolina, just to use one example, about 43,000 jobs are lost every year because of licensing laws. So you don't need corporate welfare or handouts. You could create thousands of jobs here in the Tar Heel State just by reforming occupational licensing.
Is North Carolina especially stringent when it comes to licensing?
Yes. We've ranked all the states, and North Carolina, I'm sad to say, was 17th worst. So not the very worst, but more hostile to small business owners than most states, and that's unfortunate.
How does IJ deal with licensing?
We attack it on multiple fronts. Obviously, first and foremost, we are a litigation firm. And so one of the things I do is I go around the nation filing pro bono lawsuits where we don't sue for money. And I don't charge my clients anything. Instead, I represent small business owners in cases where I ask judges to throw out unconstitutional laws. Additionally, we do quite a bit of legislative work and activism, you know, in the hope that sometimes comes true that the government will do the right thing with us without us needing to sue them.
You've had some wins in North Carolina.
Absolutely. So we had a case in Charlotte just a couple of years ago representing someone who had to get a license to teach makeup. Right. To teach makeup. She had to get a license. Just this wonderful, hardworking, aspiring entrepreneur. And so we filed a First Amendment lawsuit because the thing being regulated was our client's speech. And thankfully, the state of North Carolina decided not to fight back, and we reached a resolution. And so she has her business today. We also have a case, which isn't an occupational licensing case, but we have a challenge in North Carolina's CON law, Certificate of Need. I've had a food truck case in Carolina Beach. And so we've been pretty active in North Carolina. To be fair, we're active in most states, but there definitely is work to be done here.
Tell me more about this case involving the client who wanted to start a makeup school.
She was actually contacted by the state of North Carolina. They did an undercover sting, likely in response to some sort of online, some sort of complaint from someone who noticed online a competitor that there was going to be an unlicensed competitor. And so the state of North Carolina contacted her and informed her that if she were to actually teach someone how to put makeup on, she would be committing a crime.
Her proposed makeup school didn't match up to the state's regulations?
Anytime you have a one-size-fits-all approach, you're going to run into those problems. And so we see it over and over again, both with cosmetology licenses and with all different types of licenses, where they ensnare sadly, often intentionally. People who aren't really trying to do what the license is all about, but the people in charge of creating those licenses are just trying to prevent competition.
We're chatting with Justin Pearson of the Institute for Justice. You also mentioned success in a food truck case.
We see kind of a similar dynamic with food truck laws, where cities are increasingly realizing how popular food trucks are, but they still don't want competition. Carolina Beach passed a law that said anyone could have a food truck as long as you were also a restaurant owner in Carolina Beach. And so Carolina Beach had no problem with food trucks. They just didn't want so-called outsiders, and this is the word they used, outsiders, coming across the bridge and competing with their local restaurant owners. That's not just wrong. That's unconstitutional under the North Carolina Constitution. And so we were proud to bring a lawsuit on behalf of some food truck owners. Only a week later, the city threw in the towel, and now food trucks are allowed in Carolina Beach, even if you don't own a restaurant there.
Are these legal cases changing government attitudes about licensing?
I hope so. You know, I would hope so. That might be a little overly optimistic. Maybe someday we'll bring enough of these lawsuits that local governments and state governments will start caring about their state constitution and the federal constitution. I do think there is an increased awareness, but I still think most state legislators and most local politicians don't give much thought to constitutional law when they pass these laws, sadly.
Do you hope that some government officials will see the light and change occupational licensing rules on their own?
Absolutely. We don't have unlimited resources, right? We can't file a lawsuit for everything the government does wrong. That's a long list. And so anytime the government does something right or fixes a problem on its own, that frees up our resources to attack a different problem. And so we love it when the government does the right thing. That's why we're happy to work with legislators, some of whom will reach out to us for guidance, and we're happy to provide it. But when they don't, then sadly we have to file lawsuits.
What about people who say that a lot of these jobs should require a license?
When you look at the different states, many of whom will have some licenses but not others, and then those licenses won't exist in other states. And so when you compare a state that has a license with a state that doesn't have a license, for almost all of these licenses, there is no positive impact on quality, health, or safety created by these licenses. And so that fear is really unfounded. However, to the extent that a legislator needs to do something, and oftentimes legislators say they feel like they just have to do something, well, it turns out that there is an entire spectrum of options that they have available. This could be required registration, required bonding, required insurance. There are all sorts of things that can be done short of banning lawful employment. Banning someone from having a job should always be the last resort. And that's how it used to be. You know, in the 1950s, only 1 in 20 Americans were required to have a government permission slip to work. Now it's up to over 1 in 4. That's not the way things are supposed to work in a free country. And so this ban on work that was only supposed to be a last resort has now become oftentimes the first resort of legislators. And that's usually because entrenched interests ask for it. Right? Anytime a business goes to the government and asks to be regulated, that should be a huge red flag. But instead, what's happening is that politicians are caving to the demands of powerful interests and banning competition. And that just hurts everyone.
Are more people starting to understand the downside of occupational licensing?
We do see an increasing awareness. That being said, there's a difference between awareness and reform, right? And so one of the things that's frustrating is there's now a bipartisan consensus that reform is needed. I don't know how many things that the Trump administration and the Obama administration agree on. This is one of them. And you would think that that would lead to reform, right? When you have people on both sides of the aisle clamoring for reform, but then you go to state capitals and it's very difficult because the current entrenched interests are able, unfortunately, to usually fight back against that reform, even though that reform would benefit society as a whole.
Are you optimistic about licensing changes in the future?
I'm optimistic that things will continue to improve. IJ has a tremendous track record of success in a number of areas. And even in occupational licensing, we have already seen improvement. Now, whether we'll get to the place where I would like things to be, like, well, we'll probably never get all the way there. But I'm proud to just keep chipping away at these regulations, because every time we get rid of one of these regulations, thousands of jobs are created. And that's a wonderful thing. And not just any jobs. They tend to be jobs that disproportionately go to disadvantaged communities, low-income communities, first-generation Americans, second-generation Americans. All the people who government claims to want to help, like small business owners, when you get rid of one of these regulations, those are the people that are being helped. And so every time we get rid of one, whether it's in court or through legislation, like, that's a wonderful thing. But that being said, the typical state has between 300 and 500 discrete occupational licenses. So, you know, we might get rid of a couple here or a couple there. It tends to be a drop in the bucket. And so, you know, you savor the individual victories, but we're well aware of how high the mountain is.
Bottom line, what should government officials know about occupational licensing?
As a matter of principle, the government should get rid of many of these occupational licenses, right? The government should not be arbitrarily preventing people from pursuing the occupation of their choice. But even if the government doesn't care about principle, they should care about jobs. And all you have to do to create thousands of jobs in North Carolina relatively easily is just reform occupational licensing laws. It's a shame it hasn't happened yet.
Thank you, Justin Pearson, attorney with the Institute for Justice. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Busy times are ahead for the University of North Carolina system. Interim President Bill Roper offered a recent preview.
We'll soon be in the midst of reevaluating how each university within the system's peer institutions are identified across the nation. This is intensive and important work because those peers are a part of how we gauge our own performance in terms of research productivity, graduation rates, faculty salaries, and many other metrics. We're also collaborating with each of our institutions to clarify the individual missions of the universities. This is a critical step towards making sure that each institution is serving its region and its students, and that program offerings and research priorities and other activities aligned with the individual missions. Much of the work ahead of us is critical to the system's push to maintain our competitive advantage in national higher education. For example, we're exploring strategies to address demographic trends that are affecting college enrollment nationally. As you're aware from the conversations we've been having, we face changing demographics nationally that are affecting institutions around the country. Thus far, we have continued to grow in the aggregate for the UNC system, but the challenges will come to North Carolina in the years ahead. We're smoothing pathways into the UNC system, and we're finding more ways to serve a higher percentage of traditional students, adult learners, and military students. We're not just focused on getting students in the door. We want to also ensure that we attract and retain the best faculty and staff to serve them, including using the resources we have to compensate faculty. Our budget and finance team is studying the feasibility of consolidating the university system's debt management. By channeling all debt through the system office, we could potentially help institutions borrow money at a lower interest rate, streamline the debt issuance process, reduce the workload at the institutional level, and take advantage of higher economies of scale. We're evaluating new approaches that will make North Carolina's higher education system more robust and more efficient. We're looking for a variety of ways to do what we do through shared services and efficiencies. Just one example is our current effort to make summer school the norm rather than the exception, which will allow students to finish on time with lower debt.
That's Dr. Bill Roper, interim president of the UNC system. He's previewing major items in the university's near future. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina courts have been dealing with the issue of funding for public education for a quarter century. Why? To what end? What's next? Here to help us address these questions is Jeanette Doran. She is president and general counsel of the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me, Mitch.
So, first of all, we're going to get into some of the current issues involved in this case, but this is a case that dates back to the mid-1990s called Leandro. What's it all about?
Well, Leandro is a case, Leandro versus North Carolina. It was filed in 1994. So it's literally been a quarter century. And in that case, there were some students and their parents from what's been described as relatively poor rural counties, and then students and their parents from relatively large, wealthy counties. And the school boards from those counties sued the state of North Carolina and the State Board of Education, and they were really contesting the manner in which schools are funded. And the allegation was that the students were not receiving a constitutionally conforming education because counties supplement school funding.
So it was a school funding case when it started. It's gone through the courts, up and down, couple trips to the state Supreme Court, and it has changed over the years, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. So the first case, again, it was filed in 1994. It went to the Supreme Court the first time in 1997. And in that decision, the Supreme Court really gave us a couple of important holdings. One, they said that the state constitution requires that the state provide students of the school or students of North Carolina the opportunity to receive a sound basic education. So opportunity to receive a sound basic education. And then they went on and said the disparities in funding were not unconstitutional. There's a specific constitutional provision that allows for counties, local units of government to add to or supplement funding that they receive from the state for schools.
This case has a long involved history, far longer than we have time to get into. But one of the latest pieces of this is a report that came out that suggests that North Carolina should spend another $8 billion over the next 8 years to help address the issues that are spelled out in this case. Where does that report stand, and why is that important for this legal case?
Well, before we get to that report, and it's called the West Ed Report, it's important to remember that after that 1997 Supreme Court decision, there was a trial. It went back through appeals. So we had another Supreme Court decision from 2004, and then it went back so that the trial court could sort of come up with a remedy, because the court had found that students were not receiving an opportunity to a sound basic education. So that's why it's still going on. And what the trial court did in March of 2018, at the request of all of the parties, the plaintiffs and defendants, they hired this consulting group out of California called West Ed. And in June of 2019, West Ed produced a 300-page report with various recommendations. That report was not made public until just last week, December 2019. And in the report, West Ed lays out a number of recommendations, including an $8 billion increase in spending. They also make recommendations about school funding, funding for charter schools, and plans to continue monitoring Leandro complying or Leandro compliance. We don't know what the court will do with that report, though.
We are chatting with Jeanette Doran. She is president and general counsel of the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. One of the reasons that you're interested in this case is because there is some suggestion that the judge in the case might consider issuing an order for the state to spend that additional money. Why is this something that we should be watching very closely and be concerned about?
We shouldn't just be concerned about it. We should be terrified by that prospect. It really hits at the core of separation of powers. The state constitution lays out very specifically what the process is for creating the budget. The General Assembly enacts the budget. The governor executes the budget, administers the budget. The courts have no role in that. What's concerning or would be concerning is for a court to come in and require or attempt to require that the legislature spend a certain amount of money on education. If they can do it for education, a court could order specific funding for just about anything. And that's really not an appropriate function of the judicial branch. Money can only come out of the public treasury pursuant to an appropriation made by law. There's a specific constitutional provision about that. It's called the Appropriations Clause. We know that the General Assembly is responsible for writing the budget. The judicial branch should not be in the business or should not become in the business of writing the state budget or specifying how much money should be appropriated for this, that, or the other. It really is a separation of powers issue.
And there have been some recent court cases in which judges in North Carolina have recognized this. Aren't there specific cases within the last couple of years where judges have said, look, this is the General Assembly's job. It's not, in some cases, the executive's job, or in other cases, the judicial job to say how the money is spent.
Right. We've had some Court of Appeals cases and even Supreme Court cases over the last probably 20, 25 years. Very recently, about a year and a half ago, there was a Court of Appeals decision, and the court very clearly said the most that a court can do is issue a judgment or a decision ordering something, but they can't order the General Assembly to appropriate money. That just isn't what courts are allowed to do, because the Constitution's so clear that the General Assembly has that authority, not the judicial branch.
In the time that we have left, this obviously 300-page report talking about the future of public education could provide some valuable items, but it sounds as if the constitutional course would be for this to be something to go into legislative debate, or the governor could recommend that the General Assembly use this. But really, the courts should not be turning to this report for some sort of order.
Exactly. It's not unusual for experts to provide opinions for judges or for legislators. And that's really how we should view this, is as an expert opinion to be considered by the General Assembly as they develop a budget for our schools and for all the other essential functions of government. But it isn't appropriate for a court to come in, wholesale adopt that, and attempt to usurp the legislative authority of the legislative branch to enact budgets, to appropriate money. That just is not something that courts can do constitutionally, and they shouldn't even try. But if the legislature wants to look at that report, along with other reports, talk with, consult with experts, that's certainly appropriate.
We know one person who's going to be watching very closely is Jeanette Doran. She is president and general counsel at the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch.
We'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Well, there's no shortage of complaints about the high cost of health insurance and the high cost of health care itself, but there are ways for North Carolina lawmakers to help lower the costs. And interestingly enough, it has nothing to do with Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Jordan Roberts is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He's been writing about this. He joins us now with the details. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You are writing that we must pay attention to the 53. What are the 53?
So those are the amount of mandates that the state of North Carolina says that if you're a private insurer and you're going to offer a product in this state, you must provide coverage for these 53 different sets of, you know, services or procedures or protections, coverages, things like that. And so, you know, over time, these have built up and built up to a number, you know, very high. And, you know, it's something that private insurers have to deal with when they want to come into the state and offer a product, is these 53 mandates.
What impact does a mandate then have on the cost? How does that work if I'm an insurance company and I'm pricing my product and sure. I take a look at everything that's required?
Yeah. So when you're looking out, you're designing a benefit program, you look at what the state tells you you have to cover, and then you you incorporate that into your health benefit plan. And so what that means is then you then have to go out and find a provider who offers that service, and you contract with them. They become an in-network provider. But what this does to the entire health benefit plan is that all the covered lives in there, it's concentrated benefits and diffused costs. So what that means is that the benefits that each of these mandates convey is only to a small population, but the costs are spread out over the entire health plan. So for each mandate that the state adds on, we each pay a little bit more to ensure that coverage in the health plan.
Jordan, if you take a look at some of the items on the list, and by the way, Jordan actually has posted the list of these 53 state health benefit mandates. You can find them at johnlock.org. If you scan the list, Jordan, you see things that clearly, if you know someone who is suffering from a particular diagnosis or a problem, it really does bring up the emotion in you. And is that how these mandates get added to the list? Because there's such a compelling emotional story attached to someone who is afflicted with a particular problem?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. And, we refer to this as the special interest effect. And so essentially what happens is, well-organized trade associations or things like that are able to, effectively lobby the state legislature to say, this is an important issue, and I have a group of, follower supporters that, this is an important issue to them. So therefore, you should mandate that health insurance, cover this. And so that's how it happens. It's a tough sell to say that, these people right here standing in front of you will benefit from this. But what, is hidden is the costs that are spread out to everyone. So, while these do help a small individual amount of people, what it does is that it decreases the competition among health insurers, because if each health insurer has to provide that benefit, then there's no meaningful difference between, the companies that are offering products, and they can't compete for your business. So, that's where we get these inflated prices and, no real competition in the insurance market.
Has there been any research, Jordan, on how benefit mandates impact the costs? I mean, you've talked anecdotally, and it makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. If you're the insurance company, the more you are required to cover, then the higher you're going to have to price your product in order to make sure that you are adequately prepared to deal with all that. But is there research that shows that indeed is how it plays out?
Absolutely. Yeah. As soon as the Affordable Care Act was put into place, they had what they called the 10 essential health benefits. And, that was a big deal, was that, Obamacare required that every health plan sold on the Affordable Care Act exchanges and most other employer plans have to cover these 10 essential health benefits. And research shows that, a large portion of the hikes in health insurance is directly attributed to those mandates, because when health insurers are, forced to provide this, then they have to spread those costs around to all of us, and we pay for that. So it's minuscule, but they add up over time, and as more benefits are added on, and health insurance looks similar from company to company because they have to provide all the same benefits.
It's interesting you would mention Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, because mm-hmm. it has its own 10 essential benefits, the mandates there, but those are completely separate from the 53 we're talking about at the
Correct.
State level. So it's really two levels
Correct.
Of these cost drivers that mm-hmm. have been added in.
Yeah, and imagine being an insurance company trying to operate in this market where, the federal government's telling you have to provide all these benefits. The state government's telling you have to provide all these benefits. You need to go build an adequate network to have people come in and buy your plan and say, I'm going to get all the care I need, and that, messes up the insurer's ability to freely negotiate with, private providers, because, the providers know they have to provide that. It messes up negotiations, and, we all end up paying more is the bottom line.
Jordan, the pushback on the view that benefit mandates are cost drivers is, well, what's someone supposed to do if they have a diagnosis like this?
Mm-hmm.
Will the market take care of that, Jordan? If someone has a particular thing that's going to be quite expensive to treat, will there be players in the marketplace that crop up because there essentially is a demand for a particular type of care and coverage?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, you know, what we see in a free market is where there's a demand, you know, it's going to be met in some way. And so if we got the state government out of regulating the business of insurance and just allowed, you know, any type of health insurance product to be offered, people would have choices and could, you know, view the plans that, you know, best fit them. And so health insurers would have options, way more different levels and, you know, degrees of intensity of plans that, you know, you could buy. And there will always be people that, you know, have these certain deficiencies or, you know, problems that need to get treated. So, you know, allowing the market to freely meet that demand is how you do it, rather than mandating and having all of us pay and, you know, messing up the free exchange or free negotiations that health insurers have with providers.
Jordan, I think one of the most interesting details in your writing about this has to do with the state health plan, because you point out something that people may not realize. And there are tens, even hundreds of thousands of people covered by the state health plan, right? Mm-hmm. State employees. Yeah. How did the benefit mandates affect them and their costs?
So when a plan is self-insured, meaning that the plan sponsors assume all the risk, they don't pay premiums to an insurance company, the self-insured plan is not subject to any of the mandates from the federal or state level. But, you know, here in North Carolina, we do have a large self-insured state health plan. And, you know, it being the largest purchaser of health insurance in the state, unless explicitly said through statute, these benefit mandates don't apply to the state health plan. And, you know, I think the one reason is that legislators realize that, you know, these impose extra costs when you regulations, you know, get passed on to consumers in the form of higher prices. And so, you know, there's this discussion about when Obamacare was going through whether members of Congress would have to join or not. It's the same thing. They know it's not an adequate product, and they know that these benefit mandates raise the prices for everyone, and they're included in that price. So it's an interesting little tidbit there.
It really is. And you can find that interesting tidbit in the piece that Jordan has written about this. It's titled Health Benefit Mandates. All you need to do to get it is just go to johnlock.org. Jordan Roberts is healthcare policy analyst for the Locke Foundation. Thank you, Jordan.
Thanks.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.